Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, people are using words like unlivable to describe parts of California, where wildfires and power outages are driving new kinds of crisis and exacerbating existing ones. At the heart of it, climate disruption, of course, but also a private utility system that isn't now and never has been incentivized to address it. As we record the show, young Californians are sitting in at Nancy Pelosi's office saying business as usual is over. Media should be looking forward, too. But will they? We'll talk about the drive for a publicly owned, community-controlled energy system with Johanna Bozua, co-manager of the Climate and Energy Program at the Democracy Collaborative. Also on the show, listen to this sentence from the New York Times. Quote, "Weeks of unrest around Haiti, coupled with rampant corruption and economic malaise, have led to soaring prices, a disintegration of public services, and a galloping sense of insecurity and lawlessness." Close quote. Weeks of unrest have led to insecurity. Economic malaise causes prices to soar. Coupled is the best way to describe the relationship between the unrest and the corruption and/or malaise. This word salad is the kind of earnest carelessness you exhibit when you're talking about someplace unalterably foreign. Haiti, the upshot is just an unholy mess that might not even reward the effort to make sense of it. It's a useful dodge that lets the U.S. off the hook for its past and present role in immiserating Haiti, which is indeed in severe crisis. We'll hear about that from Jake Johnston of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. That's coming up, but first, a quick look back at recent press. In this case, it's a look at a lack of press. Specifically, corporate media silence on the October 25th arrest of journalist Max Blumenthal, editor of Gray Zone and a prominent journalistic critic of U.S. policy toward Venezuela. Blumenthal was arrested by Washington, D.C. police in connection with a protest at the Venezuelan embassy. But as Joe Emmersberger writes for Fair.org, if you're relying on corporate media or even leading press freedom groups, you won't have heard about this troubling encroachment on freedom of the press. D.C. police arrested Blumenthal at his home on a five-month-old arrest warrant, charging him with simple assault for his attempt to deliver food to the besieged Venezuelan embassy. Listeners may recall that in April, activists invited by the Venezuelan government stayed in the embassy in Washington, D.C. for over a month, delaying the takeover of the embassy by representatives of the Trump-appointed Venezuelan government in exile led by Juan Guaido. With the complicity of D.C. police, Guaido supporters tried to block food and water from being delivered to the embassy during the standoff with the activists. Blumenthal explained that had the government at least told me I had a warrant, I could have voluntarily surrendered and appeared at my own arraignment. Instead, the federal government essentially enlisted the D.C. police to SWAT me. He was held for 2 days. In the first 36 hours, he wasn't allowed to speak with a lawyer. In an interview with Fair, Blumenthal noted that keeping arrestees, generally poor and black, from speaking with lawyers or family is par for the course in the D.C.'s criminal justice system. So the warrant was months old and had apparently been previously denied. What was new was Blumenthal's Gray Zone report on how the USAID has been funding Guaido supporters to lobby the U.S. government on Venezuela. As we record the show on October 31st, there has been no mention of Blumenthal's arrest in outlets like the New York Times, Washington Post, or Reuters that regularly publish Venezuela-related content, or by the big press freedom NGOs. When freelance U.S. journalist Cody Weddle was detained in Venezuela for 12 hours, it made headlines in the New York Times, Washington Post, Miami Herald, USA Today, NPR, ABC, and Reuters. You get the idea. The human rights industry also responded immediately. Human Rights Watch tweeted about Weddle's detention, as did Reporters Without Borders. The Committee to Protect Journalists put out a statement immediately. So far, they've had nothing to say about Max Blumenthal. The point isn't, obviously, that Weddle's arrest should not have gotten widespread attention, but that, as Ben Norton, writing in Gray Zone, pointed out, of Blumenthal's arrest, quote, if this had happened to a journalist in Venezuela, every Western human rights NGO and newswire would be howling about Maduro's authoritarianism. It will be revealing to see how these same elements react to a clear-cut case of political repression in their own backyard, close quote. And now we see. Of course, Blumenthal's arrest is just another example of the legal harassment of U.S. government critics, including WikiLeaks' Julian Assange and whistleblower Chelsea Manning, whose plights have similarly been neglected by Western media and also some NGOs that claim to support press freedom. There is always room for many concerns, of course, but perhaps a fraction of the energy devoted to worry about Russian manipulation of information could be repurposed to hold our own authoritarian politicians and politicized police forces to account. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. It's difficult to grasp the distress and dystopia of Californians right now, on alert for the next wildfire or power shutoff, learning their kids' school is closed or they may have to move house for a while. But how much more disconcerting to see media coverage referring to their situation as the new normal. USA Today at least found one Santa Rosa woman who said she is not willing to accept that idea. But what could journalism be doing to not just give context to the factors behind California's current crisis, but to illuminate different ways forward that are so obviously called for? Johanna Bozua is co-manager of the Climate and Energy Program at the Democracy Collaborative. She joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Johanna Bozua.
Hi, thank you so much.
Well, can we just get some informational grounding here? The power outages that we heard about earlier this month were planned by the utility company Pacific Gas and Electric because they were concerned that power lines might trigger wildfires in high winds, as in fact they did last year, leading to the most deadly California wildfire on record, 85 people killed, which in turn led to PG&E declaring bankruptcy. But my question is, not being facetious, is this the plan? You know, going forward, is it PG&E's idea that they will shut off power whenever conditions are such that fires might be sparked, which due to climate disruption is going to be an awful lot of times?
There's a lot of history that's here in terms of PG&E not investing in its grid for so many years and really putting shareholder profits ahead of the infrastructure that we now have, which has created this concept of the new normal. But it also doesn't have to be. I mean, having these power shutoffs come on again and again, Governor Newsom has even said these are incredibly not surgical. They are doing blanket shutoffs because they're afraid of liability, but they're also not providing the infrastructure that communities need to actually make it through these. So their phone lines are off. You can't get onto their website, and there's only a generator station for every county. And so that's just showing that this is not just them taking precautions. This is them severely mismanaging a situation in which people are losing their power and losing access to maybe life-sustaining medical apparatuses as well.
Well, and you point to history. They aren't just any utility that is being forced to deal with climate disruption. There's more that we should know about the role they've played vis-a-vis climate change, isn't there?
Oh, yes, definitely. And the Energy and Policy Institute had a really important expose. We hear a lot about Exxon new and Shell new on the news, but utilities new too. They were part and parcel to the climate disinformation campaigns that have happened in the past and have sowed disinformation. And PG&E was a part of that as well. So PG&E is not a good actor in this situation. They are the ones that were able to make money off of fossil fuels for so many years and stopping action on climate change for years as well. And now they are paying the price with their own infrastructure that they failed to invest in so that it was ready for the new climate that they had in part given us.
Well, alternatives are not just possible. They are, as you write, waiting. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about the idea of public utilities.
Yeah, absolutely. So I advocate that PG&E should be transitioned into public ownership because it can eliminate some of those warped incentives that are associated with monopoly investor-owned utilities that operate our energy system. And we can move towards a situation in which a public good is provided by a public service. So by moving to a public institution, we are going to have hopefully a more accountable utility whose shareholders and stockholders are us. It is the people who are living in California and not the shareholders who are hundreds of miles away. You talk a lot about the media. It's been really interesting for me to look at some of the coverage that's been happening around the investors that are circling PG&E right now. They're saying, oh, we'll take it over. These venture capitalists like Paul Singer, who has been in bed with the Koch brothers for years, investing in anti-climate sentiments. And we see the same thing with Berkshire Hathaway, which is another major utility company that has been trying to stop distributed solar across the United States, just the type of resiliency we need for California. But there are other options that are on the table right now, and they're in action. San Francisco just put in a bid to municipalize their area so that they could take back the grid, so that they could be in charge of their own destiny. And similarly, San Jose, one of the biggest cities that PG&E provides service to, is saying, actually, you know what we should do? We should create a cooperative utility so that it is beholden to the people of California, and we're taking over PG&E at the statewide level.
Well, as we discussed when we talked about public banks on this show with Trinity Tran a few weeks ago, the word public isn't like, you know, pixie dust. It doesn't automatically make things work in a better way, but public utilities would have certain, you know, criteria about being democratized, about being decentralized, about being equitable. It's not just a goal, in other words, but a way to get there and who is involved in the process.
Absolutely. It's not a silver bullet, but it does provide us this opportunity to have more recourse. And the other thing is we're building this thing from scratch, right? Or not from scratch. There is a history of public ownership in the energy sector, but we have the ability to design into that institution things like decentralization, things like equity, things like a democratized system, and build upon what we've seen work in the past and also where we've seen public utilities historically fail. This is a huge opportunity for California to create an energy system that's rooted in climate justice, that's rooted in the realities of the changing climate and how they're going to ensure that they actually are creating a resilient California.
Well, finally, I was struck by this line in the Washington Post. It said, quote, even a year ago, it was unthinkable that California, one of the most prosperous states in the country, which has spearheaded climate initiatives and taken the national lead in electric vehicle adoption, would be put in a situation where whole neighborhoods have a choice between sitting in the dark or relying on noisy gasoline generators to keep life going, close quote. And I thought, really? Unthinkable a year ago? Maybe by you, but I'm pretty sure folks were thinking it. What would you like just finally to see maybe more of or less of in terms of media coverage of this set of issues?
Well, you know, I would love to hear from people more often actually discussing what something like public ownership could look like, really interrogating the models of utilities and the incentives that are there, which we've seen a little bit of, but really then defining what these alternatives could look like, thinking about the fact that we actually aren't stuck in this model, and the fact that we are in this climate crisis means that more than ever, we need to be thinking about climate justice. More than ever, we need to be thinking about how our democracy works, because the reality is that PG&E has failed us, and many investor-owned utilities have failed us, and it's because there is something inherent in that model that isn't working, and we need to confront that head-on in our media.
We've been speaking with Johanna Bozua, co-manager of the Climate and Energy Program at the Democracy Collaborative. They're online at democracycollaborative.org. Her article, Pulling the Plug on PG&E, can also be found at thenation.com. Johanna Bozua, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much.
The New York Times chose to headline an October 20 report, There is No Hope. Crisis pushes Haiti to brink of collapse. The phrase was a partial quote from a source, a despairing young woman in one of Haiti's most difficult areas. And the story's photos didn't lie. People stepping cautiously through streets full of uncollected garbage, newborns in necessity-deprived hospitals. Nor did the facts. At least 20 killed and hundreds hurt in protests, schools closed to millions of children, layoffs and those with jobs going unpaid, roadblocks, blackouts, hunger and stress in a country in severe crisis. Deeper in the piece was another quote from the young woman's mother, who, in tears along with her daughter, told the paper, "It's not only that we're hungry for bread and water, we're hungry for the development of Haiti." As a point of emphasis, the difference between there is no hope and there is no hope under this system is crucial. So we should think about how media coverage can hinder rather than help that kind of conversation. We're joined now by Jake Johnston, Senior Research Associate at the Center for Economic and Policy Research and lead author for CEPR's Haiti Relief and Reconstruction Watch blog. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Jake Johnston.
Thanks for having me.
Well, just to acknowledge, we can't do justice to the history of Haiti here, but I think it's fair to say the more you know of it, the more sense you can make of what's happening today. I wanted to just start with the question of the real scope or nature of these ongoing and recently escalating protests. It's set up as President Moïse versus an opposition that wants him out. But you say that's too narrow. It's really bigger or deeper than that. What do you mean?
There's been this narrative, again, that you mentioned, that this is, you know, a fight between two political sides. And I think, you know, that is really taking a far too narrow view of this crisis, which is not just a month old or 2 months old or a year old, but has been building for many years, maybe many decades, right? And this is really a systemic crisis. And I think what people are looking for, right, is not just a change in leadership, not just a change from one politician to another, but real reforms that are going to fundamentally change the system of governance and the economic system that has gone along with it. You know, we've seen the sort of failures of the democratic system, declining participation in elections for more than a decade, and an economic system that simply has produced inequality on a massive scale and failed to address the needs that are so well pointed out in that New York Times article that you mentioned.
Well, let's do some history. We've complained countless times on this show about how elite U.S. media can portray black and brown countries, and especially those deemed insufficiently pro-U.S., as uncivilized or backward or, in fancier terms, trapped for years in cycles of political and economic dysfunction. When the role of outside actors like the U.S. does come in, you need to look alive. So here is this New York Times historical rendering. They say, quote, Haiti was once a strategic ally for the United States, which often played a crucial role here. During the Cold War, American governments supported, albeit at times grudgingly, the authoritarian governments of François Duvalier and his son Jean-Claude Duvalier because of their anti-communist stance. In 1994, the Clinton administration sent troops to restore Jean-Bertrand Aristide to power after his ouster as president, but 10 years later, intense pressure from the United States helped push Mr. Aristide out again. Close quote. Now, we can't unpack all of that, obviously, but given that that was the only bit of U.S.-Haiti relations that that story included, and it's more than some stories have included, what are some key things to know about specifically the U.S. role in Haiti and about that history?
It's good to see at least some acknowledgement of the important role that the U.S. plays in Haitian politics, right? I mean, I think you look back, you know, after the fall of Duvalier and the sort of early movement towards democracy, and you had the overwhelming election in 1990 of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, focusing just on that coup that happened after that, just 9 months into his term, and the fact that there were people on the CIA payroll who participated in the coup and participated in the bloody crackdown that followed. Can really see that as sort of a transformative event that really put Haiti off the rails of democracy, and you've sort of seen it further eroded over time. And again, you often look at the past when you're talking about U.S. policy, but I think what's really important in today's struggle and what's happening today is taking a look at the more contemporary intervention of the U.S. And then that, I mean, particularly in the 2010 election, where the U.S. government alleged fraud on behalf of the government of René Préval and his chosen successor. And Hillary Clinton even came down to Haiti to force the government to overturn the results without any statistical analysis and put Michel Martelly into the runoff election. And I think you can see the sort of political fallout that has taken place in the now nearly 10 years that have taken place since that intervention right there. And I think you're seeing the collapse of that political system that really owes its power and position in power to the intervention of these foreign powers, including the United States.
Well, it's interesting, talking about today, we don't need to get into how someone at the Times could bring themselves to type the words, the Trump administration has urged respect for the democratic process. What we are seeing is calls from some folks within Haiti for involvement from the United States and calls from a lot of folks for no involvement from the United States. I mean, if we're talking about interventions from the outside world other than reparations, I mean, what sort of involvement, if any, would the majority of Haitians even want from the U.S. or from the international community at this point?
Yeah, I think this is a key question. It looks like a bit of a paradox, right? I mean, how can you denounce intervention at the same time? Clearly, there is an effort to sway international opinion in the current environment. And I think it actually makes quite a bit of sense to think that that's straight up hypocrisy assumes that the status quo is that the U.S. is not playing a determinative role or a significant role in Haitian politics. I think it's not so much further intervention that is needed, but rather taking their hands off of that system, reducing that intervention to allow Haitians to actually create a path forward for change. So often, international actors in Haiti have been the arbiters or the guarantors of the status quo. We've seen this concept of stability over and over again. I mean, there was 10,000 troops there in a stability mission. But what has this stability brought, and who is this stability for? This is stability for foreign investors, stability for the political and economic elite, stability for U.S. politicians who don't have to deal with the threat of migration or some crisis becoming a political issue for them. But it hasn't been stability for the majority of the Haitian people. And I think that's really the fundamental misanalysis, if you will, of those international actors in Haiti, is that the stability that they've sought has only been of an unsustainable status quo. And I think that system is clearly sort of collapsing right now.
Let me just ask you one question about the kind of corruption line, which is very prominent in the media coverage of Haiti today. When I read a gloss that says the government, the Moïse government, may have misappropriated billions of dollars meant for social development projects, I get an image of a benevolent and generous international community that graciously sent tons of social development money to Haiti, you know, and that at that point, corruption was introduced. And I'm not saying that there aren't corrupt Haitian officials or elites, but the idea that we, the international community, gave and gave and gave a lot of assistance, but somehow when it got to Haiti, it got perverted. I mean, what's your reaction to that?
That's an excellent point. It's a shame that it has to be said, but of course, Haitians don't have a monopoly on corruption. And if you look at the foreign aid system that we've set up and perpetuated, we as the United States, as the United Nations, as other international donors, et cetera, NGOs, the system that we've created is one that is inherently corrupt in and of itself. If you think about it, it's really a system of legalized corruption where, again, you know, we see money go to expensive salaries, cars, lodging, security, back to head offices in Washington. You know, when I was tracking money after the earthquake, what was so shocking was that I was in Washington, and yet most of the money was both allocated from Washington and ended up right back within the greater D.C. area. And so you see this sort of corruption perpetuated on this international scale. It's often not thought of as corruption because it's the system we've created and we've legalized. But in terms of wasting money, it's probably a more efficient system at wasting money than what is traditionally thought of as corruption. It is obviously interesting, you know, the focus of these corruption allegations in Haiti today focus on a subset of foreign aid coming from the Petro-Caribe program. Now, this was very different than other foreign aid in that it actually went to the government as opposed to traditional aid, which overwhelmingly, about 99% of it, bypasses the government entirely. You know, that's actually a really unique way to approach aid and something that I think the aid community more broadly has sort of coalesced around as a positive development, that you need to involve these local authorities and that it's only through putting money into these local authorities and building up these institutions and capacities locally that the issues of corruption will eventually be addressed. But I think it's a lot safer for international officials, for international media, to focus on the corruption of the Haitian government and not, obviously, of the corruption of their own governments and their own institutions, which have contributed to this over the long period of time. And if you take even a further step back and you look at the system, again, this foreign aid system that we've created, it has eroded the power of the state and the financial capacity of the state over many, many decades, again, of just bypassing the Haitian state and the Haitian institutions. And the result of that is a weak state that is more susceptible to corruption. And so I think even to the extent that there is local corruption, you also have to look at the international role in establishing the systems that facilitate that corruption.
We've been speaking with Jake Johnston, Senior Research Associate at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. You can find their work online at CEPR.net. Thank you, Jake Johnston, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Always a pleasure.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information, you can check out our website, fair.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.